Finley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is George Finley. I'm the manager of government-related in Toronto, Alaska, Incorporated. I'm here to testify in support of HB 207 House version and in opposition to the draft version dated 4/29/95. The overarching issue here is Alaska's response to worldwide competition for oil investment. Alaska's leaders have told us that it is in the state's best interest to compete successfully for more capital. We have been urgent in responding to requests from the state on ways to do this, and we see a simple step strategy. The first step is to quickly signal to investors that the state has a desire and ability to change. If passed this year, this is what the House version would do. The second step is to harvest the major opportunity to increase industry investment. This should be an early outcome of the Oil and Gas Policy Council. The third step is to implement a long-term process that would give the state the flexibility to have a competitive position, even if worldwide competition or market conditions change rapidly. When we saw VersionF on Friday, we felt very disappointed because it meant that important state leaders appear to be questioning whether even the most modest first step should be taken to increase Alaska's competitiveness. Although a slight improvement, today's version would still water down the effectiveness of the bill that passed the House. It introduces new concepts that have received little public discussion. In fact, we find this version to be less helpful than current law and cannot support its passage. Let me mention a few examples of the shortfalls of this working draft by comparing it to what Alaska's competitors are doing. Internationally, greater discretion is being given to oil ministers to make arrangements that will attract investment. In the working draft, the focus on legislative non-disapproval would work in the opposite direction. Even more confusing is the criteria for legislative oversight. By definition, royalty adjustments can only be given if the new fields would not otherwise be produced. In other words, it seems it would never be a royalty reduction, since the base case is no development, meaning zero royalty dollars. Internationally, greater uncertainty is being given that investors can count on getting the benefits enumerated in the law. Under the working draft, the added procedures and limitations would be so bureaucratic and onerous. It is unlikely that anyone would apply under these conditions. Finally, oil provinces are making agreements that share risk but give reasonable certainty. They establish prospectively a method that retains a higher share when economic conditions are good and a reduced share when they are not. The wording on page 3, which apparently gives the commissioner the ability to reopen this agreement, is a fatal flaw in this version. We support the House version not because it's a giveaway to the industry, but because it withstands comparisons to other oil provinces. ARCO has no specific projects to propose today which will use HB 207 provisions, yet we strongly support its passage this year. Because we could, with this passage, answer our corporate decision makers that Alaska has turned the corner and is truly vying in the international arena for capital. Each of us at ARCO wants the tools to get a larger share of capital for our company to make investments in Alaska. The House version enjoys many strengths. It is a modest but real first step. It sets the stage for Alaska both to really begin to return to international competitiveness and to partner with its most important natural resource industry. It also has broad consensus because the bill merits that support. Therefore, Mr. Chairman, we respectfully register for the record our opposition to the working draft version today and our support of the House version originally referred to your committee. Thank you.
Mr. Findling, On page 3, that you know, where you talk about the commissioner having the ability to reopen the agreement, we specifically in drafting this sought to clarify that wouldn't happen, but that in the contract or in the agreement there would be the conditions for the adjustments. And are you looking at the current version when you're making that statement about reopeners?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I've had a short time to review this bill. I was looking on page 3,
paragraph
12.
Yeah, lines 8 through 15?
Yes.
And you still believe that what's written there allows that reopener provision without it being pre-negotiated?
That was our initial reaction to it today, Mr. Chairman, yes. But the word subsequently determined, we're subject to some interpretation here. And we assumed the more rigorous interpretation that perhaps the commissioner would feel like he had that discretion after the deal was struck.
Okay, we'll we'll work on that to clarify our intent. Certainly my intent would be that we'd negotiate that out in the original agreement. One other point, you say here where you says important state leaders appear to be questioning whether even the most modest first step should be taken to increase Alaska's competitiveness. I don't want to be presumptuous and think that perhaps you're referring to us, but and if you are, I don't know that there's anybody here on this committee who is present right now who is questioning taking even the most modest first step toward increasing our competitiveness. Would you want to explain who you're referring to and specifically what you mean?
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't focusing on any individual. Our thought is that the state of Alaska is falling behind in international competitiveness. The laws that govern the regulation of our industry were developed in the 1970s. The world is completely different today. In our view, the House passed version of that of 207 is a modest first step, but it's only a first step, and there are many more steps that need to be made, as I alluded to in my testimony. And our thoughts were that watering down the House version of the bill was contrary to the realization that House version is just the first step.
And when you say watering down, I mean, I guess it depends on how you look at it. We look at it as just being a way to ensure that the process that has been followed is in the best interest of the state. It's kind of like we approve the state's royalty oil contracts. None of us, to the best of my knowledge, got actively involved in the negotiation of that, and yet, best as I can determine, we're going to approve that, and I'd be surprised if the vote isn't unanimous, you know, which is saying, Commissioner, you did a good job.
Yeah, I wasn't referring to royalty contracts. I guess what I said in my testimony, the focus here is on international competitiveness in our mind. The focus is on what is the competition doing, and that's the criteria by which we evaluate the effectiveness of this bill. So some of the additions that have been made since the House version to this working draft, in our mind, as I indicated in my testimony, work contrary to the way the rest of the world is behaving to attract investment. So that's what I mean by watering down.
Are you aware, Mr. Findling, of anywhere else in the world? I've asked this question of others, and nobody else has given me a specific example of anywhere else in the world where this provision that is in this bill, that even in the Senate version we're providing, is provided elsewhere, whereas previously leased land that is not developed can be subject to negotiated downward royalty rate.
Mr. Chairman, no, I'm not. But I think that's besides the point. The main point I see here is I don't see any other oil province that has exactly the same rules and regulations as Alaska. So I look at this whole point of how we are regulated as an industry from the totality of those statutes and regulations, and then compare them to statutes, regulations, and processes in other oil provinces. And very much in other oil provinces, there are processes in place that allow the state or the governmental take of profits to vary with conditions. The worse the oil price, the lower the take, the higher the take. The United Kingdom is an example that we've given in Senate testimony that has a straight corporate income tax, which effectively works that way. So I can't pick out a specific place where just a royalty reduction, as we're speaking here, is exactly applied, because it really doesn't fit into the context of all the rules and regulations that are pertinent in other oil provinces.
You know, not to belabor this, but you know, I happen to agree with you that royalty flexibility is a good idea. But if nobody else in the world does this, is it really that unusual or watering down if we just require that the legislature approve such a deal if its value is greater than $10 million, in 4 years from now, revisit the issue in a sunset review.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I guess, as I said in my testimony, I'm still struggling with how you get to a valuation in dollars. The whole premise, as we've seen it in the first part of the section, not the point to page 2, section A, for the new fields. The premise there is that these are fields that would not otherwise be developed and produced. So I don't see where the reduction in royalty is in the, when expressed in dollars. It seems to me that it's contrary.
Senator Frank.
I think my question was already answered.
Or for holding you so long that you have to wait for somebody else to ask it and get it answered?
No, that's fine. I was just going to ask about it.
Okay, we're moving on to Jim Branch in Anchorage and then Kevin Tabler.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Branch. I'm the production manager with responsibility for Exxon members here in Alaska. And again, thank you for staying to this late hour to receive our testimony. I do appreciate the opportunity to follow up on my comments from last Tuesday about the need to send a positive signal that our state is trying to improve the investment climate for the oil and gas industry, and this bill is just one aspect of that signal. We've supported the efforts by the administration and the legislature that attempts to provide clarity, predictability, and reasonable balance to the Commissioner of Natural Resources existing authority to grant royalty relief. The administration's original bill and the substitute that was reported out of the House, we believe, had that intention. However, the current Senate Resources version appears to send a very negative signal to our industry. The changes made to the final House bill are significant and numerous, as many of those commenting tonight have pointed out. So rather than go line by line through the bill, let me return to some principles for a well-designed incentive, which I offered in my testimony of early February to this committee. An incentive is ineffective if an investor concludes that it can be taken away over time, has a hidden price tag, or creates an environment for future disputes. This version of the bill would do all of that. The suggestions of reopeners, sunset provisions, legislative review, and repeated references to value and marketing of oil and gas are enough to discourage any serious investor. These conditions send the opposite message to the one I hope you ultimately intend to communicate. Investors are keenly aware of the poor investment climate in our state relative to the other opportunities available to them, and they're looking for indications that change is possible. The result of the debate on this bill, and we believe more importantly, the progress on fiscal reform, primarily through spending reduction, are measures by which we will all be judged. Until spending is brought more in line with revenues, oil and gas investors will be wary of placing significant new funds in this state. Our industry already provides 85% of the state's funding, and there's a history of looking to us to fill revenue gaps. I applaud the leadership this legislature has demonstrated in beginning to address the fiscal situation. As I've said in the past, investors are prepared to assume the traditional risks associated with finding and developing oil and gas, but not those created by the state in the forms of concerns over increased taxes or uncertainty over an incentive granted under this version of House Bill 207. With their versions of this bill, the governor and the House demonstrated their intention to attempt to provide clarity, predictability, and reasonable balance to the DNR commissioner's current authority to revise royalty. I urge you to reconsider some of the changes that you've made to this bill. And again, thank you for the opportunity to provide my comments at this late hour.
And thank you for the comments, and thank you for providing them in writing to us, Jim. Kevin Tabler. And then we're going to go to Fairbanks, if Fairbanks still online, to Richard Feinberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kevin Tabler. I'm land manager for Union Oil Company of California here in Alaska. First off, I'd like to congratulate Mr. Boyd on his recent appointment. I appreciate this opportunity to be heard today and to present UNICAL's comments on this committee substitute of the House Bill 207. I'd like to begin my testimony by saying that the sectional analysis provided with the bill is particularly helpful in making a more informed analysis of the bill. Some of the concerns I expressed in last Wednesday's hearing have been clarified by the analysis, and therefore, in closed testimony, which I provided, I believe, to your committee, my facts earlier today, more accurately reflects UNICAL's view and opinion of the bill today. So I'd like to go by section and briefly touch on a few items that have not been touched on today and also highlight some that have. Subsection J1 of the current version we're looking at, from purely a UNICAL perspective, based on its present acreage position in Cook Inlet, UNICAL is not directly impacted by paragraph A. Most of UNICAL's leases held today are located within producing fields, some of which are nearing the end of their economic viability. We have, however, testified in earlier hearings on this bill that we have not endorsed the concept of sunset provision. I can move to subsection J4. We believe the requirement for legislative approval under paragraph A will be a time-consuming and unnecessary requirement resulting in an administratively burdensome process. Under the House Finance version of the bill, adequate commissioner oversight is provided under subsection J8. In reading the provisions of paragraph B of this subsection, it is unclear to me as to the intent of the language in amount or value of production. If this is to mean a net 3% floor or a maximum 75% reduction of the current royalty rate, then UNICAL is opposed to version. Under the House Finance version of the bill, the floor established for producing and shutting fields is 90%. There needs to be clarification on this point. Any increase in the floor reducing flexibility would be inconsistent with our position and prior testimony. Subsection J5. Although we appreciate the attempt in this CS to address the assignability question we raised last Wednesday, we believe a strong argument still exists for elimination of this restriction altogether. The assignment of all rights, title, and interest in a lease is a fundamental principle in the oil industry. Property trade will be greatly restricted if assignability of a royalty adjustment is not allowed. Because of the confidential nature of property transactions, companies are not going to disclose their intent to the public in asking for permission to assign until negotiations are complete. And commitments have been made. Prior approval does not work in a situation. A negative response to a request for assignment could jeopardize a potentially beneficial trade to the state. The ability and desire to acquire a lease that has favorable royalty terms may be the catalyst and incentive for a company to invest capital and employ new ideas in fields where the current owners may be less inclined. Companies are rationalizing properties and focusing investments in core areas to take advantage of their particular operational infrastructure or informational strength. Lost opportunity for additional development of a lease or field is sure to occur if this unnecessary limitation is imposed. The intent of this legislation should be to create opportunity with certainty, not further limit the creativity of the industry. The state's best interest will not be served with this restriction. Section J7, this deals with the contractor section. This issue of contractor selection was thoroughly discussed in prior hearings with what we thought was an equitable compromise and consensus opinion of the parties testifying. We see no advantage to changing this subsection and would prefer to see subsection 6 of the House Finance version reinstated. Subsection J9, best interest findings. Reviewing and addressing all the requirements under this subsection will be a very extensive, time-consuming, and may not be applicable in all circumstances. We believe the commissioner should have the discretion to provide for the contents of the best interest finding and determination. The Department of Natural Resources is well equipped for this process. The extent to which each of these conditions are to be investigated will be the subject of much debate. If the committee and legislature feel the need to include the details of the finding and determination in this bill, the paragraphs A through B should only be suggestions of issues the commissioner may consider, not requirements in a royalty adjustment application. Finally, in subsection J12, we have a similar comment in this subsection as in subsection J4. time-consuming and administratively burdensome. We contend that subsection J10 of the House Finance Bill is more appropriate and should replace this subsection. In conclusion, we want and need a bill and process that is clear, fair, flexible, and equitable. Otherwise, we will end up with a piece of legislation that is underutilized. We look forward to working with the legislature as this bill progresses through the legislative process. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tabler. Senator Taylor?
Mr. Tabler, would you please comment on page 2, lines 10 through 13, subsection large letter B of the House version?
Of the House version?
Yes.
Right here in the packet. Should be
in the
packet. And that was 10 through 13, you said?
Senator
Taylor?
Yes.
I'm not sure what you're getting to, whether we Unicom would approve of this provision or like the wording of this.
I'm sorry. There's a difference between the two versions. On page 2, lines 10 through 13 of the House version, subsection B, it starts off to prolong the economic life of an oil or gas field, pool, or portion. In the work draft, paren B on page 2, line 18 through 20, it says, to prolong the economic life of an oil or gas field when the field's operating costs exceed its revenue, etc. Could you comment on those two provisions, and am I juxtaposing the right two provisions, or have I confused them?
No, I believe you have the same provision.
Your
our comment,
please.
As we stated in earlier testimonies, is it is one in support of the House language. Much debate was ensued over the concept of field pool or portion of field or pool.
I guess I'm trying to understand what the words increase or decrease is sufficient to make future production. I mean, don't they both say the same thing?
They are somewhat similar.
I guess that's my confusion. I'm not sure how they are different or if you see differences in them.
I have to confess that I did not see much of a difference in those. However, the language referring to pool or portion of the field or pool would be more applicable in a royalty adjustment application that may be presented by an applicant. It provides more flexibility for that applicant.
I see. Thank you.
Do we have anybody from the division who would care to comment on that particular provision? I believe that at least at staff level, we've discussed this. Do you care to comment on it this time, Mr. Boyd? Or
I'm sorry.
This would be paragraph B. It appears on page 2 on both the House version and this Senate version. There's a different way of defining this. We're trying to get at this term economic feasibility, and just to define it at the tail end of a field that's producing. It's just when your costs exceed your revenues, and then, you know, because I would assume that an operator will continue to operate as long as you're making money when you're down at the tail end, and we just want to have a very clear definition of this.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is John Shively. We do have a problem with that language because I don't think it exactly captures what might happen. What you've said here is that if a field's operating cost exceeds its revenue, there are possibilities at the end of the field, depending on how long that could be, where you might need also to make a capital investment. The language as you have it here would not allow that capital investment to be taken into account, and therefore I think would nullify that particular opportunity to make this legislation work.
Thank you. Senator Frank?
I don't understand what a field's operating costs
and a field's operating revenues are. I mean, I don't know how those are defined. Do we have definitions of those in the law?
Mr. Chairman, not to my knowledge. This is not our language.
Well, is that a good question, or is that a stupid question?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's a stupid question. We have talked about operating costs, and it certainly, as we've explained how these royalties would be looked at, when the economics of field are looked at, you're really looking at sort of three things, what we call the cost, which are operating and capital costs, the price of oil, and the volume of oil. Those are the primary things that would go into the analysis. Operating costs, to me, generally are those things that it would cost to really, you know, pay for the people that do the field, the electricity, whatever else it goes to really make production go. Operating revenues is a less definitive term to me, and I'm actually not sure, even from my business background, exactly what operating revenues are, as opposed to some other kind of revenues.
So how are you supposed to make a decision about all this?
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to get into a difficult situation here. We have suggested that there are language problems like this that we want to continue to work with the staff on, and we, as I expressed before you came, we basically do believe that the House bill is adequate to resolve these problems, but we've been willing to work with the staff to try to fix these. But this is not our language. This is committee staff language.
Well, if I was looking at the House, then I guess I would just ask what per barrel or barrel equivalent costs, how you define that. And how you define economic feasibility.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Boyd, and I'm the Director of Division of Oil and Gas. The language in the House version is more general, and as Richard Shively said, the language you're discussing in the committee CS is not language we drafted. Per barrel costs are the cost of a barrel of oil. Per barrel equivalent is the equivalent value of gas. As costs increase or the price decreases, we say that if you can't make the field go, then you need a royalty reduction. You have to make this decision in the finding. It's just a more general statement than the equation or the formula that you have in your committee substitute. It just gives the commissioner the latitude that says if prices increase or decrease, cost increase or decrease, if you can't make your production feasible, and again, feasibility can be determined through a finding process, then your royalty reduction is warranted.
So what would you include as field cost? Is that what it is, field cost or total cost or operating cost, or how do you define it?
It's which bill are you on?
Well, I was looking at the House version. Huh?
Yes, well, that was usually.
I mean, you have to make an economic decision if you guys are probably going to be the ones that do it. And if you're looking at the cost, I'd like to understand your analysis, you know, your thought process. What types of costs do you allow and what types of costs don't you allow? And how you assign overheads and, you know, transportation costs and that kind of things.
I don't think we're talking about that in Section B. I think we're talking about strictly the price of oil going up or down. And as that increase changes, the per barrel equivalent cost is the gas equivalent of the price of a barrel of oil. And as those costs increase or decrease, in the end of the life of a field, can you still keep the field alive without a royalty reduction?
But
I understand your objective. I guess I want to understand the mechanics of the analysis on how you determine whether it is economic or uneconomic. Maybe you haven't said it very well.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I think that's a broader question, and I that's not a science at this point. What will happen is that the applicant will come to us with a proposal. That proposal will be based on certain economic factors, including what they believe, if it's a new field, what they believe it will cost. That cost will have in it some overhead. It will, they will probably give us a projected return on investment or hurdle rate that they think they need. It'll be based on some kind of price analysis, and they will have a suggestion of volume. We may agree or disagree with all or some of those assumptions, including, you know, what is legitimate overhead, what are the costs. Once we've looked at that, assuming that we or using outside consultants can come to some agreement on the economics and do agree that the economics justify a reduction at the time, then the legislation allows the opportunity, the House bill, and this bill and the Senate substitute also, to say, okay, if those economic assumptions change, if the price of oil goes up $4 a barrel from our base assumption, what changes with the royalty? The reason that I have been particularly intrigued with this concept, and I think it's somewhat misunderstood, I am actually much more interested in the upside of this legislation than I am of the downside in terms of state revenue. I think that giving a royalty reduction up front provides us with an opportunity to get fields going, but one of the three legs that I've talked about, volume, is, as Mr. Feinberg, I'm sure, is just about to testify, it's really always lower when the field begins. And that's natural because they haven't delineated it. So if there's more volume, we have an opportunity at the end to get more revenue. But there's not an exact science here. We don't have a formula that's spelled out that says that overhead should be 7% of operating costs or whatever. That's just something that we will look at as part of the entire analysis. In addition, to be frank, different oil companies will have different economics. An ownership in the pipeline, for instance, could drastically change the economics between one oil company and another. So I can't tell you, sitting here, you know, exactly what we would do for every proposal, and that's one of the reasons we've wanted to keep it flexible, is because we're not sure what kind of applications we might get and what the fact situations in each of those proposals might be.
I'll just tell you my understanding of that change. It was to simplify this, to just make sure that the process is very clear in terms of when this would be granted. It's my understanding, when Mr. Commissioner, when your staff met with my staff, that either there was no problem with that or it wasn't discussed, and I'm somewhat surprised to hear such a strong opposition to it right now when it wasn't expressed about 5 days ago in our work session.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you know, I was not at the work session. This has been, you know, there have been a variety of changes. If we did not catch it or did not object, I apologize for that. We're not trying to blame people. As we said, the language part of it is something that I think we have the opportunity to continue to work on. I think our staffs have worked in good faith, and I think we can fix all those. There are some conceptual things here, though, I think go beyond that I think make this draft more difficult to deal with. But we're willing to continue to work on the language as long as anybody wants us to.
Oh, I doubt that we're going to work on this beyond Wednesday.
Mr. Chairman, this is Kevin Taylor, Unical again. I think when I referred to being more flexible, and I think the commissioner has also indicated that, is that in the work draft that the Senate has proposed, it says when the field's operating costs exceed revenue, which is a point in time, whereas the idea of time when you would make a capital investment in a project may be prior to that time. So you precluded the ability for a company to make long-term planning, long-range planning based on acquisitions, based on their infrastructure, based on consolidations, rationalizations in these old mature fields. as to the timing of when you would ask for royalty relief. These old marginal fields and mature fields are very price sensitive, and as you know, the cost per increment, part of the cost per unit goes up as the life goes on, and at that point, there is a point in time when you exceed the revenues that are coming in, and the amount of black that comes out of the ground is directly proportional to the amount of green that goes into the ground. So we believe that the House version provides more flexibility for the commissioner to take those sorts of conditions into consideration.
Senator Frank?
Have you guys worked through an example of a hypothetical, you know, that would take us through, you know, the price, the components of the cost, and how much royalty is, how much severance is, how much transportation is, how much lifting costs are, and that sort of thing, so we can get some understanding? I mean, I don't know much about this stuff. But I'd like to see some kind of a working example as to how it would work. And to me, that'd be very helpful, because my responsibility as a legislator is to ensure that we are doing what's in the state's best interest. And I do want to be encouraging oil development, but I want to make sure that we're doing what is going to both create jobs plus bring some dollars to the Treasury if we're utilizing state royalty or state oil. I guess it's just the royalty part. But so I'm trying to understand this, and I have, frankly, we've got a lot of testimony here that says we got to do this, because it's good, but yet I haven't been shown, and I haven't had the opportunity to spend a lot of time, but I'd like to see kind of the mechanics of how it'll work, and that would help me a lot.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frank, I believe that BP is going to give us an example that they've had. We have not worked through example. We will look at that example also and try to give you, and we will give you our comments on it. So, and we certainly would be pleased to spend any time you need to go through that.
I'd like to go to Fairbanks and pick up Mr. Weinberg and then back to Anchorage.
Yes.
To Tom
Lockish.
Just be, Mr. Weinberg, are you still online?
Mr. Chairman, I am. Thank you very much.
Can you hold, Ms. Feinberg?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Can you hold just a second? We have one final question of the commissioner.
I certainly can. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Pierce?
Thank you. Mr. Commissioner, the governor has proven himself to be very cautious on a number of areas, from not supporting getting rid of Monte Carlo nights because we're not letting 44 permittees know what we're doing to them because we don't have time in the final 2 weeks of the session to let everybody know. I mean, time after time after time, he said he wants to take things out to the public and get the people behind it and so on and so forth. And yet, I think I just heard you tell Senator Frank that you've never worked through an example of how you would utilize the mechanism you're asking us to give you. And as I understand the way the bill was drafted as it came over from the House, it allowed for not legislative approval, although some oversight by LBNA, although you couldn't do anything about something once it was already done, and also language that would tell the court that it was not appealable. Somehow, someone who doesn't want to do a simple, well, simple, somehow someone who doesn't want to get rid of Monte Carlo nights for $75,000 a year, but is willing to hand you a blank check on an entire oil field, I'm lost. I truly am. I don't understand what's the fear about having some oversight.
Well, yeah, you've asked several questions. I'm not prepared to debate the Monte Carlo night situation. I have not been involved in that I think one of the differences, however, to be frank, is that this legislation, particularly in the House, received extensive hearings, extensive input by the public. There has been previous hearings here that there's a slight difference in timing. In terms of the appealability, nothing can keep the decision ultimately out of court. And if the commissioner did something that was absolutely fraudulent, and we testified to this in the House, certainly because of the equal power of the branches of government that you discussed, they could get into that and would get into it. We've tried to limit that. We're particularly concerned, really, on the side of it of the owners of the leases, that they understand that this particular proposal in the legislature is not a right, that it's a privilege granted by the state at our discretion. And so what we were trying to do was to make sure that they couldn't come back and say, well, the commissioner didn't do this and we have a right to this reduction. And that was why the leaving of the discretion in there. In terms of the oversight, other oversight of the commissioner, I would again state, when we looked at it in the House in terms of other parts of government itself, of the executive branch, really there was no one with the expertise in the economics of an oil field that could make these decisions, and that's why I believe the House ultimately went to a briefing by LBNA, although there was some disagreement on the House floor as to what that oversight should be, but that's ultimately what they passed. In terms of whether or not how we can possibly do this without ever having run an example, we can run any kind of example, any kind of economic example anyone wants. I don't know that that's particularly real. We have had a number of people who are, including our economists within the department, look at this, and we believe it is a system that works, that we could administer, that we could make a decision on. And really, as I testified in the House, the protection for the state government is not in the commissioner, and it's not in the governor. The protection for the state is in the rank and file of the Division of Oil and Gas. This state has been blessed, I think, with some very good professional people who I do not believe, and I think that anybody that ever dealt with Jim Easton would understand this, and I expect the same of Ken Boyd, that would ever tolerate the commissioner just giving away the state's assets. So I really think that the protection for the state is right where it ought to be, which is the professional people that are designed to make this decision. And that's why we feel strongly that there should not be other kinds of oversight where there is not the expertise to make the decision. I don't know if that was a longer answer than you expected, Senator.
Good answer.
Thank you.
Senator Frank?
Well, just on that, I'm not necessarily a big fan of the legislative oversight because it is problematic. Some people say they're comfortable with it and at the same time comfortable without it. But I guess I'd like to think that if your people made a decision, a recommendation to you, and you follow through on it, that would also be something that you could convince, you know, the rest of the people of Alaska about through the legislative process or something like that. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be... Are you saying it's so technical that a regular person couldn't understand it, or are you saying that political elements could screw it up?
Well, I think there are three parts to the answer. One, I think it could be a little technical. Secondly, I mean, there is no question that occasionally politics do enter into the legislative decision-making. I mean, that's part of the good and bad news of how the legislative body operates. But thirdly, and what I think has made the oversight particularly difficult, is that this legislation does provide that certain information be confidential. And so how that confidential information would be dealt with in a body as public in the legislature, I think has caused some concern by the industry. And so if you take, for instance, the example that's been used here tonight, the Tesoro contract, the royalty gas contract, there's really not any confidential information in a royalty contract. So that I think that's really the key difference that could make it difficult to deal with, is the confidential information.
Commissioner, I think we have ways to deal with the confidentiality issue. We can run it through our Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. That committee, if it wishes, and you know, when it comes to highly technical things, could, just as you would do, hire consultants that would, you know, help use that information, and they would be sworn to confidentiality too. So I think each of these arenas we can deal with. You know, the politics. I don't know. I guess there's probably politics in everything, but I think that in fairness to the legislature, that ultimately the legislature would treat this very carefully, and I think every legislator would probably view their responsibility as a trust responsibility to the people of the state of Alaska very carefully. I guess that's my defense for the legislature. I won't defend everything the legislature does by any
means. And I won't defend everything the executive branch does. So.
I have another question. Maybe I'm clarifying some of my questions in my mind now. Maybe I'll be able to express them better. If we're not going to have an oversight, I think as a legislator, I would like to know more about the methodology that will be utilized by the experts that make these decisions. And it seems like the bill... has kind of a trust me aspect to it that if I'm not going to get a chance to look at it later, I'd at least like to know that the methodology has been determined and is something that I can be confident in. And it doesn't sound to me like that's been done. It doesn't sound to me like the methodology is something that is contained in any other jurisdiction or has been done already, and it's something that I could understand.
Well, Mr. Chairman, a couple things. One, there are other jurisdictions that do things like this. There are jurisdictions that give guaranteed rates of return where they have to make these kinds of economic decisions. So the royalty reduction might be there, but the method for analyzing is not unique. However, I would have to say that we can't give you one methodology that would be used. Different companies have different ways of viewing projects and may bring this. One oil company may say, when we view an oil project, we view it at what it does at a certain low rate of oil, and that's the key for us. And therefore, we wanted a royalty assumption based on what happens with that low value of oil, and then we would fill in the formula for increases value. Other oil companies may deal with it on a longer term average of the price of oil. And of course, the price of oil is probably for the most part going to be your big variable right here in making these decisions. So we can show you.
So you would have a floating type thing? The royalty would go up and down with the price of oil, perhaps?
I mean, if we're going to give the oil companies a break, given a certain set of low economic expectations, if those increase for the better, then, yeah, we have a right to get our money back and perhaps even get a higher royalty. I mean, that's the way this legislation is designed. And so...
Conoco decision at Millie Point would be an example of something they could have.
Yeah, we do have a way we made a decision at Conoco at Millie Point that we could share with you. But again, we'll give it to you. But it's not necessarily going to be the way we always do it, if that's what you're looking for. But we can give you some
examples. What I'm looking for some greater comfort level that the right decisions get made for the right reasons, and that we've exercised our fiduciary responsibility to protect the states.
You want to know that there's a way or more to get to the answer that you expect us to
get. I'd like to understand how it's going to work.
Okay. Well, we will provide you with that information. We'll try to get it. Can we get the Conoco decision sometime tomorrow, right?
I may have already provided that to the committee. I just can't remember if I gave you a copy of the Conoco. Okay, I can get it, or you already have it, or it's real close.
Yeah, I just want to remind you, Mr. Commissioner, and the others of the time constraints we're operating under. This could be the last week of this legislative session. I'm assuming that that's the case for purposes of dealing with this bill. And with that being having been said, for the Finance Committee to get this bill and do something with it, we're going to have to move it by Wednesday. Which,
we
which makes our interactions and exchange of information highly critical. And we do it and do it in an open, candid way so we can get these detailed results.
We'll get you the Conoco decision tomorrow. We will look at the BP example tomorrow and give you our comments on that. I think, and if we think that you need something else, I'm sure that we can have something tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you. I thank the two gentlemen who've been standing by and waiting or sitting by, Mr. Feinberg and then Tom Lackish in Anchorage. And I believe, unless there's a list somewhere that I don't have, that will be it. And Mr. Feinberg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hate to sail against the wind. It's not something I'm used to doing. But at the risk of doing that, I do want to compliment you and your staff for what is obviously very careful drafting. It is very clear that you take your trust responsibility quite seriously. And I, for one, am quite grateful to you. I suspect that I could do you a larger favor in view of the overwhelming testimony you've heard by not complimenting you, but I think it should go into the record, at least to some who have followed this. With all due respect, the House bill had huge defects, and it seems that you have made a good faith effort to cure some of them. I do not support the bill. That will come as no surprise to you. But I think the record should show this has much merit to it, and I have heard no recognition of that tonight. I'm very disappointed in the testimony I've heard in that regard. Very quickly, with regard to your draft at page 3, lines 4-7, I wonder if you want to add transportation factors into your new section, as you did in subparagraph 6A, line 14, page 4. I suspect you might want to add it. I don't know for sure. I simply found it for you. Number 2 on your draft, with regard to confidentiality, I believe it is now at page 4, lines 18 through 21, saying you shall, that the commissioner shall keep the information confidential at the request of the petitioner, citing the statute for type all confidentiality. Once more, I must say, you're flying against the notion of common sense and sunshine laws and the courts who have dealt with such. And I suggest that the testimony you heard earlier, that there will be no problem from the public as long as we've got money, I don't, as long as we show revenue or production, I don't agree with that a bit. I believe you will have concerns from the public until you cure that defect, at least from some sectors of the public. You are taking the public's right to know, on a blanket request, depriving the public of that right to know. On the blanket application from the industry, by granting them in the statute automatic confidentiality on request. I believe that all of your reviews right now at page 5, lines 28 through 32, and page 6, lines 11 through 15, these are your subparagraphs, town A and B, the reviews will be flawed by the confidentiality, as will the public public input, one might guess. I don't want to belabor that further unclear on the written record. Let me go back to the pipelines very quickly to clarify something that came up earlier from Senator Taylor on pipeline tariffs. For the record, I believe it should be very clear, contrary to what you were told tonight, the regulated tariff is a maximum pipeline tariff. Nothing prevents the carrier from lowering the tariff. That's a very, very crucial point of pipeline rate making. I simply want to clarify that for the record. The problem in pipeline tariffs that we've tried before briefly, or discussed briefly, is not that the tariffs are the same, it's that the owners receive the guaranteed profit that is guaranteed in the 1985 settlement. I again submit that that may be the reason that Conoco is no longer here. It paid that profit to BT, and that was the handicap, not royalty relief. With regards to dismantling, this is not the time to deal with it, but again, rather than looking at the incentives you might offer, I think careful observation of pipeline tariffs, careful scrutiny, might find much more fertile fields for promoting future state development of the public resource. Let me return to the confidentiality again very briefly from this direction. With regard to your earlier question, and I don't recall who from the committee asked it, is the definition of a marginal field. With your threat of business and the schedule changing, I want to make very clear that it is in the record. Marginal fields are defined in the Von Mueller study of January 95, referenced in Oil and Gas Journal at pages 43 and 45 on April the 3rd, in the Van Muren's World Fiscal Systems for Oil, in which he compares approximately 210 regimes from 135 countries, a marginal field is one that yields the producer a net present value of 220 per barrel or less at a 15% discount rate. Now, he has compared many world systems. We seem to compare to Kazakhstan. I have asked a question, but I don't know that I have done it formally to the committee. Have you reviewed and do you have reference to that study? I don't need the answer now myself. I simply want to throw it into the record for you to make sure you know where that study is referenced. I looked at the summary of it. It's a voluminous study. It can be read many ways. Some of the points, some of the data would support perhaps review, would not. But that is one place to go for your framework as to the economic necessity. With regard to the simplistic numbers you're going to receive, I would like to make a request that when you receive them, the public get a chance to look at the numbers BP is going to submit. With all due respect, the last ads I've seen commending the house show a picture of two babies behind. Quite literally, I'm not replicating Dagnon, I'm simply describing the half-page BP ads. We're not seeing substance on this. Now, I don't want to disappoint Commissioner Shively, since prior to the time that I testified, he has taken twice now the presage in what I will do. With regard to the increases in production, in the 4 hours that the hearing was delayed today, I had a chance to calculate how many barrels of increased production we have under the current royalty regime, the current tax regime, based on the average over the last 10 years. And in the 4 hours that the hearing was delayed, the 10-year average, we increased North Slope production by 280,000 barrels. If you take the last 6 month average, it was 660,000 barrels we gained in that 4 hours. In short, if you want to increase production, I can save you much time at 10:20 at night at the end of the session. Simply go home and do nothing. It is happening. I don't want to belabor that further, except that apropos of the testimony I've heard tonight, in your conclusion, for about 90 minutes, I heard a great deal about the depth of common sense at the start and then the message we are sending. I submit that in that 90 minutes in which we gained roughly 105,000 new barrels of oil that will be produced based on the last 10 years, probably 200,000 barrels if you take the current rate of the last forecast. It's again in the data I presented to you, you have in your records. But with regard to how you interpret the repeated refrain, what message are we sending, I suggest that you simply collapse the two ponderings you've had. One, the depth of common sense, and sending a message to industry. And each time you are told to think about the message we're sending to industry and we must send the message, you're hearing the depth of common sense. Finally, my own homily, since that seems to be the level up until the last hour when your very excellent questions finally began to get to the direction we need to go in considering this bill, and I commend your committee for the last 90 minutes of your questions. On the House side, I raised a Gaelic folk bromide, the jackal's mankind left the lammies nearby, by which I meant to say the wolves howl to frighten, perhaps. They don't cry unless they can gain something from that fright. I think you were hearing a good deal of that tonight. I thank you for your patience at this late hour. Again, I would hope that the public would have a chance to see the numbers when at last they come out, since I would point out that in the Elk debate in 1989, it took months to unravel the numbers and see where the examples that industry provided were misleading. And that record is very clear also. So that I commend Senator Frank for asking for those numbers. I'm delighted they're finally going to come forward. I hope somebody's going to have a chance to look at them before you move a bill. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Feinberg. And the last person to testify is Tom Lockish.
Yes, thank you for this opportunity to testify. This has been very educational sitting around here since 3:30 this afternoon. I've had opportunity to exchange some opinions. But I must object to passage of this bill. I believe it's in direct contravention of Article 1, Section 15, which describes prohibiting state action. No law impairing the obligation of contracts and no law making any irrevocable grant of special privileges or immunities shall be passed. And I would think that the notes provided by Gordon S. Harrison in his
Citizen's Guide to the Alaska Constitution, on the following page is quite applicable in this circumstance. The phrase irrevocable grant of special privileges or immunity substitutes for titles of nobility in federal version, in the federal version. This substitute language is found in many state constitutions and may reflect the reaction to corrupt 19th century legislatures giving preferences and exclusive rights to corporations such as railroads. And I believe we have the same circumstance here where there is the impairment of established lease contracts and special privileges and immunities that are being granted to the industry with this piece of legislation. Clearly, this entire legislation is designed to work to impair existing lease agreements, and that the bill inherently presumes that an exemption from an existing lease will be given because the original lease is no longer in the public interest. The state only has an authority to act on behalf of the public's best interest. If indeed existing leases are not the best public interest, they must be voided and forfeited and referred to the public domain. Thereafter, the re-leasing of those tracts must be done by established administrative procedures of competitive bidding, and no special privilege or immunity, special privilege for contracts which are not competitively let, or immunity from the administrative procedures shall be allowed by our Constitution, and that such special privileges are in violation of rights of the public interest, the rights of the Alaska residents. There are several special privileges that this bill proposes to allow. Certain ones are that only a leasee may apply for royalty adjustment. If at best we may have a cost plus arrangement, which the industry is suggesting. At worst, we will have a minimum allowable profit contract, and that is only applicable to a request from the industry. If there are circumstances where there is windfall profits, say from an embargo against one of the oil producers, the public should have the right to request an increase in the royalty, because it is inherently the public interest which you must consider under these circumstances, and which is a large part of the language of this bill as well. Another specific privilege is the privilege for the oil industry to request and receive immunity from the Freedom of Information Act. And that is not allowed constitutionally. Another special privilege is the decision of DNR not to be appealable to the court. And I'm very concerned that there's no provision, even if this could be made constitutional, that there's no provision supporting the relief granted where the projections prove to be inaccurate or the information is incomplete, false, or misleading. As Mr. Feinberg has so eloquently stated, that we have had productivity increases due to better technology, and there's the prices fluctuate so wildly that there's no way that we can guarantee that a field less fallow would not yield more royalties at the existing contractual rate if they are allowed to lay fallow until the prices do reach an appropriate rate for exploitation. And I am really upset, though, that there have been several suggestions that the legislative oversight should be withdrawn for the sole purpose of denying the public an opportunity for due process. That's a clear attempt to take the rights, the resources of Alaskans without due process. And And I think that shows that the industry is not as forthcoming as they say they are, that their intent here is to ram through legislation at the 11th plus hour, at literally the 11th hour, and without a fair opportunity for the public to receive due process at the hearings, which were continually delayed, and for the public to receive due process once again by legislative oversight. And I might remind the legislature that they go through an annual budgeting process which uses estimates of oil, and given the slack that has been previously utilized in determining budgets, that now you may be constrained by the conditions which the oil industry gets leave to proceed on. That if they're going to have a price estimate that's used in the royalty consideration, I might remind the legislators that they will have to use those same estimates in determining their state budget, so that there's going to be a question of whether you want to jack the price up to estimate how much we can spend, and they want to jack the price down to allow for a reduction in royalty. So we have a lot of considerations which should be clearly determined through the Attorney General's office, and I believe I would have the right to do so through Article 1, Section 7, which would grant fair and just treatment in this legislative investigation, and that I request that the Attorney General specifically investigate whether there is an attempt to impair contracts with this legislation or provide special privileges or immunity from law. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Lockish. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify on House Bill 207 tonight? Thank you very much for everybody who participated. And remind you that Wednesday is our next meeting time at 3:30. We'll have a schedule posted tomorrow, and we will take those bills and resolutions plus House Bill 207. And as Mr. Lockyer says, sometimes we do our best work at the 11th hour. Have little choice. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.